By now, Americans should be very used to the concept of copyright. The little circle and C symbol that appears on books, movies, music, packages, virtually anything that can carry a copyright symbol. It's as common as the air we breathe. So you might be surprised to know that law, the law of the United States, the body of rules and statutes that help enforce our social values, is, too, copyrighted. That's right. Everything from building codes to records from Supreme Court cases are under copyright and controlled under a system that puts a price on its access. Last September, we reported on the release of a new software called Recap, which helps users access normally pricey judicial documents for free. Today's guest wants to free the law from copyright altogether. Carl Malamud has been helping citizens with access to government for years. He created the world's first internet radio station and was the first to stream government meetings live online. Carl sat down with David Weinberger this week to talk about his latest project, Law.gov.
Well, Law.gov is an outgrowth. Over the last few years, there's been a growing movement of people around the country, and many of us have been putting the law online, court of appeals decisions, building codes, electrical codes, state statutes. Law.gov is an attempt to formalize this process and convince the government, the United States government, both the federal and the state levels, that all primary legal materials in the United States should be available in an authenticated repository and registry for bulk access for free. That you should be able to download the entire law of the United States. Because the law has been a private domain, right? Because companies own the law, have copyright over the law.
Okay, so we need to stop you right there. The law is a private domain. It's sort of a shocking statement in a democracy. People have copyright. They've copyrighted our law?
Believe it or not. So there's a long line of court opinions going back to Wheaton v. Peters in 1824, in which the Supreme Court said there is no copyright in the law. We are unanimous of this opinion. And that principle of jurisprudence, there is no copyright in the law, because how can you be a nation of laws, not a nation of men, if you can't read the law? How can there be equal protection under the law if you have to pay money to access the law? Despite that principle, there are states that assert copyright over their statutes. Many states assert copyright over their executive branch regulations. Many assert copyright over their court opinions. And even at the federal level, even if they don't assert copyright, they charge enough money that there's a huge barrier to entry. The PACER system, for example, is a $100 million revenue stream for the administrative office of the courts. The executive branch of the federal government spends $50 million a year accessing district court opinions. PACER is the system for district court opinions that is run by the administrative office of the court. So it's the federal district court stuff, and to some extent the circuit court of appeals decisions.
And they charge an access fee. That it's not a copyright fee, a royalty, but they charge an access fee if you want to get these materials.
Yeah, it's 8 cents a page. There's a limit of $2.40 per document. If it's less than $10 a quarter, your fee is waived. And so for, you know, occasional access, assuming you have a credit card, you can get access to these opinions. If you're a prisoner, you can petition a judge for free access. But if you're a public interest group like mine, and what you want to do is audit a whole district court for privacy violations, for example, the fees are prohibitive. It would cost millions of dollars to download enough documents to be able to do that kind of an audit for privacy. And in fact, when we got 20 million pages of PACER documents, which we downloaded through a public access facility, my colleague Aaron Schwartz did that, we audited them for privacy violations and found thousands and thousands of court cases that had social security numbers, names of minor children, financial accounts. That led to the courts redacting and removing many of these documents, and it led the judicial conference to change their privacy rules.
So let's go back to copyright for a moment, because we have a Supreme Court decision from the 19th century saying that laws cannot be copyrighted, and we have a set of states who are copyrighting their laws. Why isn't that just one court case and we're done? How do they figure that?
Well, the theory is that it costs the state money to publish this information, and by asserting copyright, they can have a commercial provider such as Lexis or West put that stuff out as the reporter of the court. And the issue got very muddy, because what happened is everybody admits that the underlying law has no copyright. In fact, you know what you do if you're a legal retail provider, right? If you're selling access to the law, you buy all the books from West and from Lexis, and you send them to the Philippines or India or Thailand, and you have them triple keyed. You have them typed three times in. That way you know they're perfect. And so we got all these vendors like buying the books and sending them overseas and retyping them in. And what the vendors say is that, well, the underlying law, the court opinion, doesn't have copyright, but we were creative and we added page numbers. And therefore, our compilation is copyright.
Well, which is what Westlaw does, in effect, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, Westlaw owns the metadata about the law.
Yeah, but, you know, it is a very dubious legal opinion that page numbers are creativity and somehow mean copyright. Pretty much everyone agrees that the head notes, the summary of a court case done by the West lawyer, yeah, sure, that's theirs. But what's happened is because the state, in many cases, will hire West or Lexis as their reporter, and the only version of this stuff available is the West version, you have this public property with a private fence wrapped around it so nobody else can go in and do anything with it. And in some cases, the states themselves assert copyright over the materials. We had a very famous incident with the Oregon state legislature sent a takedown notice to us because we had the Oregon revised statutes online. And we thought that was ridiculous.
Wow. So you had the statutes online. You didn't have the page numbers or the section numbers or the rest of the metadata that's
Oregon
been generated
by
somebody else.
Oregon is special because they didn't hire somebody else. They were asserting copyright themselves, and they sent us their takedown notice. And so we looked at that, and they said, well, okay, so the underlying law is not copyright, but we are asserting copyright over the section headings and the section numbers, right, as well as a whole bunch of other stuff. And so we went back to them and we said, look, this is just, we just don't think as a state actor you're able to assert copyright over this. If you were a private party, we might argue about whether this is creative or not. We threatened to sue. We brought in EFF. We hired our own lawyer. We did a draft declaratory judgment, and we're ready to sue. They called a hearing. We went and testified before the Oregon legislature. Oregon citizens testified before the legislature, and the committee unanimously voted to waive copyright assertions. So that was kind of democracy in action. That was very pleasant to see.
So what are you up to now?
So law.gov is an attempt to bring this issue up to the level of the federal government, because we think our president is a constitutional scholar. Our solicitor general used to be at Harvard Law School as the dean. Our attorney general is a noted scholar. And we think the idea that the law is not available is shocking. And when we go see judges and law professors and others and show them the extent of this problem, they say it is an issue. What we're doing with law.gov is a series of workshops around the country at 10 of the major law schools, Harvard, Yale, Berkeley, Stanford. And in each of those, we're discussing the issues of what would it take to have the federal government run a system called law.gov based on open source, so that any state could download the software and run their own registry. Any municipality could run a registry. What would it take to make it authenticated? How do you do markup? How do you do citation resolution? How much would it cost? We believe that this would save the federal government $1 billion over a 5 to 10 year period over access to their own work product, because they're currently spending $250 million a year with the private providers, Lexis and West, to access their own stuff. So I think there's a huge cost savings for the federal government. So what we're doing is workshops for 6 months, having a national dialogue. We are writing a report this summer over what would it take to do this, what's the business case, what's the technical case, and then in the fall we're going to hold a series of briefings. The American Association of Law Libraries is working with a bunch of law librarians around the country to do a national inventory of primary legal materials. What's out there? Is there copyright? How much does it cost? Where do you get it? Basically a bill of lading as to what a law.gov system should have.
Does this mean that we would eventually wean the legal system from relying upon Westlaw's numbers for citing cases and lines in cases? I should say I'm not a lawyer.
So there's two things here. One is, yes, I do believe that such a system would move us towards a system of vendor-neutral citation schemes in which you number a case by paragraph rather than a particular page layout in a particular rendition. But let me make a point here, which is that while this will certainly have an effect on West and Lexis, I think they will face an IBM moment. And that IBM moment is, will they grow and prosper based on their true value added, their workflow solutions for litigation in large law firms, discovery, all the true value added they do, or will they wither and die because they're simply trying to guard an enclave on top of the public domain? And I think there is a huge business opportunity for West and Lexus by expanding the size of the market, by making the raw materials more readily accessible. And I think there's a huge innovation potential here, which is small startups being able to get into business, and that's something we have not had. Legal is the last bastion of closed on the internet right now.
Other than the people who have their business model has been based upon putting a fence around the public domain stuff, how can anybody object to this? What sorts of objections do you hear?
Oh.
Or are you just too silver-tongued that
No, there's real objections. Government is not capable of running a decent system. We need the free market to build true value added. As a lawyer, you really want the sophistication of West and Lexus. All this free stuff is just for pro se prisoners.
But as you just said, you can still have value added providers who are doing all the sorts of services. How can anybody object to making the law, our law, available to anybody who wants it in any form that they want it, including ways in which private companies could add value and make it
accessible? There is an elitist feeling, and I have seen this over the last 20 years. When I first went to put the Securities and Exchange Commission EDGAR database on the internet, and we had discussions with the SEC staff, and their first reaction was, well, we just don't think this is a good thing, because they were selling access to EDGAR. And I said, well, I just want to put it on the internet. And the reaction from the head of computers for the SEC was, well, we just don't think the internet has the right kind of people on it. And I was in a congressional meeting at that point. And, you know, this was Chairman Markey's conference room. He wasn't there, but his chief of staff was. And I looked over at that SEC guy and I said, you know, I think the American people are the right kind of people. And that was a cheap shot, because what he meant was the internet was just a bunch of researchers. The only people that wanted EDGAR documents were financial professionals. Why should we subsidize their access? Right? Why should we undercut the business model of selling these documents? And we're getting the same thing in the legal world, which is, you know, all these people that want to access the law, they're not qualified. They don't have a law degree. They have no business reading this stuff, nor would they even care.
That doesn't seem to me to be a serious argument.
Well, I don't think it's a serious argument. I think, for example, a real estate professional has to understand real estate law. I think any computer executive certainly has to understand, you know, the basics of antitrust and patents. Any computer engineer has to read a patent, right? That's a basic part of the job these days. And so I think the idea that people are not interested in the law is an outgrowth of a very, you know, closed kind of feeling. But, you know, remember, the law is a conservative profession. And there are some conservative people in there that maybe have not really experienced the internet yet. They have Blackberries, but that's maybe as far as they get.
It seems to me this is not a liberal conservative issue. This is one of the most basic things. It's our law.
Yes. Well, in fact, it is not a liberal conservative issue. I used to work for John Podesta at the Center for American Progress, so I have true blue liberal written all over me. But I've gone to the Cato Institute and the Federalist Society and other groups, and I've had a very sympathetic reaction from people on both sides of the political spectrum. It is truly not a political issue. This very much spans Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative.
Do the data .gov people, the CIO, CTO of the federal CTO, I would guess that they would like this idea.
Oh, they love the idea. I've seen Vivek Kundra and Anish Chopra. So I've had a very supportive reaction from them. On the other hand, you have to remember that the CTO and the CIO are there to do the president's agenda. So they have to worry about health care, and they have to worry about energy, and they have to worry about the environment. They are not necessarily there to pick a fight with the judiciary or to tell the legislature how to publish their materials or how to do the states. And so I think they welcome the fact that an outside group of people at 10 of the top law schools in the country are convening these workshops to discuss the issue and bring to them a consensus, which will allow them to act if we can build that national consensus.
So we do have a president who has been outspoken in favor of government transparency, and is it an executive order for executive branch agencies to provide data to data.gov?
Yes. The Open Government Directive, and there's also been other material on transparency. I mean, his very first act was a transparency memorandum.
So to get law moved under this umbrella, that's not an executive branch thing.
Well, it sort of is, because, you know, remember, the executive branch produces a lot of legal materials, the Federal Register. In fact, they now make that available in XML for free. I also think it's going to take national...
But it will fall into the wrong hands if they do that.
Oh, it's amazing the hands it's fallen in. People are taking the Federal Register and doing amazing things with it now that it's available. It used to be $17,000 for the feed, and now it's zero, and it means that these hackers all over the country, the Sunlight Foundation crowd, is just doing amazing things. I think it's going to take national leadership in order to make this principle that the law must be available, and so that's why we're looking partly to the executive branch. We think it's going to take congressional action. And so that's one reason we're focusing on the federal government right now, even though a lot of the issues are at the state level. We think with national leadership, that'll help establish the principle. And once the principle is established, not only with federal materials, but pointing to the states and the municipalities, that's going to spread. And we'll have that goal of all primary legal materials being available.
When you say pointing to the states, is this ultimately for a state law? Is it ultimately a state by state battle?
My own personal view is that perhaps some federal legislation asserting that there is no copyright over primary legal materials, right, a preemption of copyright, which is based on this long line of Supreme Court decisions, might be the way to handle this issue. At that point, it becomes the law of the land, and the states really have no choice. Now, I have no idea what the federalism implications are of that, and again, that's why I'm going to places like Harvard and Yale and asking those questions.
So assume for the moment that your campaign is entirely victorious, and not only that, everything is actually put online, that we get the funding and everything's online. What will be different, and what might be especially good? What do you worry about? Do you have any fears about what providing actual easy access to the law might bring?
So we have put literally 90 million pages of government documents on the internet at public.resource.org. We're 3 years old, small 501c3 nonprofit. We put all the Court of Appeals decisions online, and there was good and there was bad. So good was you could put a citation, right, you know, 31F243, and drop it in Google, and boom, you could read the case. And that was the first time ever you could do that. You always had to go pay for access to those. Huge win, because Court of Appeals decisions are very important. You know, they're just below the Supreme Court, and there's a lot of seminal decisions. Bad news, I get a phone call from somebody saying, hey, you got my Social Security number up on the internet. And so we ran a Social Security number scan on all our Court of Appeals decisions. And sure enough, the Court of Appeals had published a bunch of Social Security numbers. So we went in and we redacted all of them. We prepared an audit and sent it to the chair of the Judicial Conference's Rules Committee, sent it to all the chief judges of the circuit courts, and they went ahead and they removed the offending ones that were on their sites. We also notified the commercial providers, and some of them redacted and some didn't. And so the downside is there's a lot of messy data, particularly at the district court level. There's bankruptcy procedures, there's IRS documents that have been submitted improperly. When we audited the district court documents, we found one which is a medical malpractice suit. And by mistake, they had published the list of all the patients, a doctor's patients, like 300 of them, their name, their home address, their psychological problems, their Social Security number, and their age. Just page after page after page of this stuff.
When you say by mistake, that was a lot of work to get that information in there.
Lawyers,
so
according
it's a very
to the
slow
rules,
mistake.
Lawyers, according to the rules, are not supposed to submit documents that have certain categories of privacy material in them. They're supposed to redact that information. Because there was a barrier to entry, because the public was not able to audit the documents, a lot of these privacy problems festered. Because of our audit of the district court opinions, there was a new rule, and the rule says every time a lawyer logs into PACER now, they have to click a box that says, I understand my privacy responsibilities. And every time they submit a document, they get a little reminder saying, have you redacted? But there's a challenge for all government documents. Many of them are messy. There's documents that have been improperly unsealed that, for example, have the names of informants in them. And because of that, there's now a system out there called Who's a Rat? And in which prisoners go online and they find out who in their cell is an informant and they go kill them. And that's been a huge problem. And so there are tremendous privacy issues that the courts in particular have neglected to address. And as this data becomes more public, they're going to have to address those issues head on and decide whether or not this information is public or not public.
What's your time frame for this?
Well, we are already beginning to see a huge amount of legal information on the internet, and the last 2 years have been a sea change. I mean, you know, starting with the Court of Appeals decisions, a huge amount of federal information has been showing up, a lot of state information. We're seeing things like Google Scholar out there, which is really breaking open part of the market. So it's happening with or without the government's participation. But the law.gov process is a dialogue for 6 months, write a report in the summer, go brief the White House and the Congress and the judges and the others in the fall, and with any luck, maybe formal action would be happening end of this year or sometime next year. You never know with government. They can make it very complicated. It could take years and years to actually do something. We think if we can demonstrate that these problems are solvable, we have a couple special co-conveners. In addition to people like Larry Lessig at Harvard and Zittrain at Harvard, John Podesta is co-convening a workshop. He used to be my boss at the Center for American Progress. He also ran the transition for the president. Tim O'Reilly is a co-convener, and we're hoping to use people like that. Tim O'Reilly, for example, we're working to build technical specs for the underlying hardware that is RFP ready, right? So that it says, look, if you're going to put 2 petabytes of data online, here's what you do. And then get prominent people like Tim to look at it and say, you know, this looks good to me. Right. So when our report goes in, we can say, and there is a workable technical solution that will not cost $500 million. You don't have to hire Lockheed Martin or somebody to build something from scratch.
And the metadata question, is that being resolved by the by similar sorts of?
Well, so metadata, you know, there's issues of metadata. There's authentication. How do you know it's the real document? There's how do you do citations? We're trying to do this based on existing technology. So there's some pretty simple things. Like if you're doing metadata, Dublin Core, you know, gets you 90% of the way there.
Dublin Core being the document, a fairly simple standard for metadata for ordinary documents.
Absolutely. You know. Absolutely. So rather than reinventing the wheel and saying, hey, we're going to like come up with some new metadata standard, what the working group is doing is trying to go through what's out there, sort through it, and say, how, you know, how far can we get with what's already there?
And just so you're not creating the 90,000 term legal ontology.
No, but there are some legal ontologies out there that we're looking at to say, are they useful? Can we do something with them? There's an interesting URN scheme that comes out of Italy, for example, on how to identify a court case. That seems to have some promise. And again, the idea is to identify the solutions that are workable today, correlate that to the corpus that's out there, and say, okay, so, you know, we want the following metadata. How does that correlate to the Court of Appeals decisions we have? Does it already have that metadata in it, or are we going to have law students sit down from scratch and type it in? And we're trying to quantify that workload, just like we're trying to quantify how much needs to be scanned of the historical corpus. Because if you're doing all primary legal materials in a precedent-based system, you need not only, for example, Supreme Court opinions, you want all the Supreme Court briefs. And they're not available today. But, you know, if you're researching a Supreme Court decision, you ought to be able to see what the lawyer's arguments were and maybe even the trial court transcript leading up to that Supreme Court decision. And so trying to kind of free that historical corpus is one of the things we're looking at.
So years, but not decades?
Oh, I would hope within years there is a dramatic change in the way our legal system functions. And I really think this is a foundational issue, right? This is not a tech issue. I had one dean of a law school we asked to co-convene a workshop, and he shall remain nameless. But he looked at it and sent it down to his computer people. And this is not a computer issue. This is about how our legal system functions. This is about the ability to do research on the legal corpus, which you can't do today. And there's all sorts of people at law schools that would love to get their hands on all the district court opinions to look at discrimination in patent suits or civil rights suits or how our system functions. There are many lawyers that are not able to access materials they need to do their job. Solo practitioners are on a research ration because they can't afford to do things. Department of Justice lawyers occasionally get memos saying, please stop doing so much research, we're over budget. Right? And so these are really fundamental issues on about democracy and justice, and we're hoping can get resolved quickly, right? That people look at this and say, this is important, and it's really not that hard to do a better job, right? This is simply a matter of will. The technical issues are really not that big a deal.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Carl Malamud is a pioneering public domain advocate and the president and founder of publicresource.org, the folks behind law.gov. You can find out more about him and his project from our website, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. This episode was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, with David Weinberger from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.